and welcome to the Cannon Fodder Podcast. I'm film critic Daniel Barnes, and I'm under the influence of fun and some beer. With me, as always, my co-host, the yin to my yang, the punch to my Judy, and in this case, literally punching the Judy. Why, it's Corky McDonald.
Hi, Dan.
What's up?
As you can see by my crafted cocktail, I'm under the ginfluence. Boom! Hey. Actually, no, I'm just drinking Gatorade Zero.
Yeah, it still works.
Not a plug. Actually, fuck it. Yeah, it's a plug. Go buy Gatorade Zero. Gatorade, that one's on me.
You're just giving free ads to Gatorade?
They're a struggling company. They could
You're
use it.
You're getting nothing out of this. Nothing at all. You're not even looking for free products, or you're not gonna nothing. It's just free advertising.
No, I do it for the love.
For the products that you believe in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I love that.
How That's you doing, pure. Buddy?
Oh man, I'm doing all right. Honestly. You know, I'm doing okay. I'm hanging out. I'm not under the influence of anyone in particular.
Right
at this moment, you know, I feel like I maybe am an influencer.
Ooh.
I don't know if I've been influencing any women, probably not. But I feel like I've got that in me, that kind of influencer gene is just sort of, it's kind of rising up here. I feel like I
sure.
might go out at some point, not tonight, it's late already, but at some point I will go out and influence someone.
Okay.
I don't know how or what that is. Again, I'm not 100% sure what a podcast is. I'm definitely like 10 to 15% sure what an influencer is.
The concept of social media is just beyond you. You don't get this at all.
I'm pretty sure I just go out and influence people in some sort of a way, just to do basic things or think things, you know.
Yeah.
Sort of just like a guy on a soapbox, I think.
Pretty much, yeah. I think so.
Yeah.
Beautiful. You know who is big in influencing is our lovely, wonderful, just the most magnanimous people mm-hmm. alive. You want to talk about people who just do it for the love of the game.
Oh, yeah.
Who got no stakes. Like, they're getting nothing back for their investment.
No.
Is our PayPal donors.
Into a black hole. Just boom. Yes. Never to be seen again. That could have been spent on goods and services.
Yeah.
Yeah, that could have been accruing interest this entire time, but wow, yeah.
Yeah, and just here, losing interest. They're probably losing interest right now, hearing us thank them for all their wonderful, just splendiferous support of the show. Mm. We couldn't do it without you, and we want to thank each and every one of you. And here we go, starting with Adam. Alphabetical order, people.
Adam.
Argus. Aziz. Seriously. Thank you so much to everybody who hits up our PayPal and supports the show.
And if you'd like to donate, you can head over to daredaniel.com, find the menu at the top of the page, and click support the show. There's a donate button on the homepage as well. You can make a one-time, I believe, weekly, monthly donation, yearly maybe. Any contribution you make helps keep this show going.
So there was a lot of talk about influencing, and mm-hmm. we're going to talk tonight about a woman under the influence. The IMDb synopsis for A Woman Under the Influence. Although wife and mother Mabel is loved by her husband Nick, her mental illness places a strain on the marriage.
Yes, this week's film, it's A Woman Under the Influence, written and directed by John Cassavetes. The film premiered at the 1974 San Sebastian and New York Film Festivals. But as with most Cassavetes films, it was made independently and shot in a very naturalistic style, featuring intensely authentic performances, largely from close friends and loved ones. In this case, his wife, Jenna Rollins, their kids, Nick and Jan Cassavetes, and frequent collaborator Peter Falk. And like a lot of the films, it was at least partially self-funded by proceeds from Cassavetes' acting roles. Again, you might know him better as an actor if you're not really a big cinephile. The Dirty Dozen, The Husband and Rosemary's Baby, Mikey and Nikki, lots of TV stuff. You would probably know him if you've seen him, if you know anything about old movies. Cassavetes originally wrote the part of Mabel for Rollins to play on the stage, but she realized she could never play such a part over and over again. She just couldn't capture that emotion 8 times a week. So he instead adapted it for the screen. No studio would back it, so he mortgaged their house. He borrowed as much money as he could. Falk put up $500,000 of his own money. Rollins did her own hair and makeup, and many of the crew members were students from the AFI, the American Film Institute, where Cassavetes was serving as filmmaker in residence. When he couldn't find a distributor, Cassavetes personally booked the film in art house theaters and on college campuses, and he and Falk would appear. They'd show up, they'd discuss the movie. All that work paid off. It became a true word-of-mouth success and was nominated for 2 Academy Awards, Best Director for Cassavetes, Best Actress for Jenna Rollins. In 1990, it was among the first 50 films selected for preservation in the National Film Registry, which is reserved for American films deemed culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. It was in that like inaugural Hall of Fame class, right?
Wow.
With like Babe Ruth and Tris Speaker and, you know.
Jimmy Fox.
Luke Gehrig. On the 2022 Sight and Sound Critics Poll, A Woman Under the Influence, it tied at number 114. And the Cassavetes film Love Streams also made the list at number 185. Corky,
yeah.
I have in my hand an imaginary breathalyzer.
Mm.
Now, if I put this thing into your mouth, sir,
mm-hmm.
again, this is all imaginary things going
clip
in your mouth.
Clip that sound bite, people.
Hypothetical. And
I just want to hear that everywhere. Corky, put this thing in your mouth, sir.
Yeah, absolutely. Am I going to be taking you in, sir? Are you under the influence of a certain John Cassavetes, Jenna Rollins, and Peter Falk? What did you think of this movie?
Well, Dan, I tell you, if I blow on that thing, sir, I'm blowing a zero, a Gatorade zero, okay? Because that's all I got right now.
Nice.
Now, for your tortured metaphor for the film and the influence-o-meter. This was a hard movie for me to watch.
Mm. Oh, sure. Yeah.
It was difficult.
It's not, I mean, there's no one fan or detractor would call this like an easy sit.
Yeah.
Sort of a movie or something like, you know, there's no comfort food coming out of this film.
Yeah, I was raised in a pretty kind of dysfunctional household. Not the exact parallel to what you see on this screen, but there's a certain unevenness of character and performance and behavior that just, it's hard for me to separate from as a enjoyment of a film. Not saying enjoying the, mm-hmm. you know, I like what's happening. I'm happy for everybody. Not that, but I'm enjoying this as a film. So it was hard for me to kind of like watch this movie. The performances are amazing in this movie. Gina Rollins, yeah. Holy shit. She's so fucking good. And Peter Falk is at two levels. He's at low and placating and confused and he's at rage or I would say, you know, he's not at two levels. He's all up and down, but those are the extremes. And yeah, it's always with
he's
like
very bipolar.
Very bipolar. Very bipolar. He's got his own thing going on.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing that comes through is that they love each other very, very much. And it's a love that exists even though he doesn't know how to be around her. He doesn't know how to live with her. He loves her. He can't help but it, but he doesn't even know how to be around her. She doesn't understand what's happening to her
mm-hmm.
and can't control that behavior, but has just the utmost respect, is always just desperate to please her husband that she loves. Really, really outstanding movie.
Yeah, I think so too. This is the second time I've seen it. It's been about 15 years or so, but man, It still packs a wallop, but it's maybe not exactly the sort of wallop that you might think. Like, this movie is not really easily pigeonholed. As I said, like, natural is kind of like a thing with Cassavetes. You could say, yeah, like, natural lighting, natural sound, natural camera work, natural performances. But a lot of times that has the feel of like, well, he's not really doing anything, but he's doing quite a lot. I mean, behind the scenes, obviously, but it's not a film that is like going to draw a map for you, right? Like, there's a lot of emotions going on, but it's all the kind of unsaid emotions that are really key here. There's this feeling that you're always in the middle of an awkward or heated or very emotional encounter, which is the last place anyone wants to be, right? So this movie is constantly putting you in the last place that you want to be, right?
Yeah.
Like, you are the guest who has stayed too long at the party where the hosts are fighting, you know? Like, it's just so awkward. And that's augmented visually with these, a lot of the film is shot close-ups or even long shots, but they're filmed with this long zoom lens, right? They're filmed from far away with a long zoom to keep, you know, the people clear in frame. But it gives this effect of flattening the background, kind of making it feel very claustrophobic. The walls are literally closing in. I mean, something 20 feet away feels like it's right on you. A person in a bar who's on the other side of the room feels like they're literally on your shoulder, right? Like, all these characters are stuck together in these airless spaces, having these emotionally exhausting encounters, right? And that sounds like, holy shit, this is like a kitchen sink sort of drama, and it is, but it's also often like bizarrely funny. Like, it kind of tips at a certain point to like, this is almost hilarious, like how exhausting this, how addicted to chaos and crisis these people are, and how they are just nitroglycerin, just like fanning each other's flames constantly. I just think to like the beach scene,
yeah,
where he drags the children out of school to the... I mean, Corky, they had more fun on Omaha Beach than they had at this beach party, okay? Like, this is the, like, most miserable fucking encounter that you could possibly have, and it's just so awful, but it's also so recognizable. Like, as you said, to parents and to children, I think, to just be like, we're here, we're having fun. Have fun. Don't have fun like that. Have fun over here. You know, it's just... everything is just always at an 11. And Mabel, this is the woman under the influence, Roland, she's a very odd person. Absolutely. Her behavior is very strange. But his behavior, Nick, is as consistently as unhinged as hers, if not significantly more unhinged. His also comes with this sort of extra layer of violence.
Right.
Verbal and physical, like, and as we said, like, it's very bipolar, because he is either screaming like a maniac or he's telling someone to calm down. You know, like don't
that
tell
they
him
didn't
to calm
do anything
down.
Wrong,
right? No, yes, exactly. Like, don't do that. Also, be yourself. I mean, it's just like, how would you not go completely fucking insane married to this person or living with this person? And they both are excellent. Of course, Roland's, I mean, it's justifiably legendary performance, but I also think Falk is right up there on that level. They capture these like tumultuous contradictions of their characters so like fearlessly, like how they just go from one place to another. Like, she goes from this childlike innocence to rage, fear, paranoia, and then right back again, right? And we see this again and again. He goes on just a similar self-destructive sort of a journey, right? But like, he's a man, he works, he leads a crew of men. Her psychosis as a wife and mother is inexcusable, and his is not, right? Like, he can push it way farther than she can. But this is a point not hammered home and underlined repeatedly, as I say, but just there in what Cassavetes is giving us, you know, with the images and what the actors are giving us with the performances. I think it's great. But yeah, their dynamic, fuck, these two, holy fuck, these two. Yes, they love each other, but they're just so bad together at the same time. But also, it's just the movie gets at this thing where it's almost like being in a relationship, keeping a marriage alive, keeping a family together almost necessitates like a shared psychosis on some level. Like you need to just convince yourself everything is fine and then get to the next day, you know, keep moving on, keep moving forward. And that's the kind of weird, ambiguous place that this movie ends at. But it almost made me think like they have this dynamic of like, sort of like Blanche and Stanley in Streetcar Named Desire, but almost like Blanche and Stanley got married. It was like, how is that going to work out? Poorly, as it turns out. But right from the beginning, marital problems. Like that's kind of where we start at, right? Like although we again, like I said, we need to get up to speed on our own. It's not Cassavetes that's going to do it.
Yeah.
Like, we're right in the middle of a chaos right away. The movie has just started. We're right in the middle of chaos. Nick breaks an unbreakable date. And she's left alone, right? Smoking and drinking. And eventually she wanders into a bar, right? And meets a man. Garson. Oh boy, this guy. That's like so many strange and really wonderful performances in this movie, not just Peter Falk and Jenna Rollins. And this is one of them, this Garson. And so many authentic ass faces, right?
Yeah.
Not central casting for these guys on Nick's crew. These are real guys, okay?
Yeah.
Like they've been on some sort of a crew. Positive, negative, good, bad, I don't know. But they've been on a crew, I can tell you that much. But yeah, this encounter, it's a little bit ambiguous, but the way it ends up, this Garson, they have this kind of meeting in a bar. She gloms onto him, gets a free drink. He takes her back to her place. He's dragging her along. She starts resisting. And then this is sort of like a Cassavetes staple, the jump cut.
Yeah.
Jump cut, like the scene ending right in the middle of something just really tumultuous and emotional to, wait, where are we? And then you need to kind of figure out where are we? And we're at the next morning, and it's just the next morning. He's still there. She's in bed. And I think we're meant to most likely assume that he's, you know, he's raped her and calling it a one-night stand, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
because she could barely even stand up and was fighting him off at one point. But then she does this thing, she's confusing him with Nick, or is that just something she's doing in her head? You know, there's this very ambiguous place. And she's a very, like, deep reservoirs of emotion, but she's also extremely unserious as a person, don't you think? Like, she's constantly doing this thing of, like,
yeah.
Making these sort of noises, throwing her thumb up, saying, nah, get out of here, get out of here. Doing like bits and things like that. Yeah, it's...
It's almost, she does it to people when she's reacting to them, but then also if it feels like if she's just in the background, she's doing it as if I'm not getting attention. Or I don't know her motivation, but it's just, it's busy stuff for her.
Yeah.
She's always manic. When we're meeting her, whether she's out drunk or sober in the morning,
and with the kids, with Nick alone.
When she's got the kids, she wants them out of her hair. When they're gone, she misses them the second they're gone. And she realizes what she's done and is trying to get this Garson guy out of her house.
Mm-hmm. From this point on, what I realized, kind of thinking back on the movie, what we get is like a series of like party scenes or dinner scenes, right?
Yeah.
There's like four or five, right? So we have this like dinner party where Nick brings over, just out of nowhere, brings over the entire crew and expects her to just whip up a spaghetti dinner for everybody.
Yeah. And this is, you find out that this is not an uncommon thing. This is
exactly.
Kind of she's married to an Italian man. It's expected that she's going to make spaghetti dinner for his crew.
And the same thing with Nick breaking the date, the same thing with her wandering out and probably picking up a man and that going really poorly. Like, we get the impression that none of this, this is all, like, the 36th time that all of this has happened, right? Like, this is, we are at the breaking point. We are at that edge as the film is starting, really.
Not a serious person. Like, she's kind of not serious. Mm. It's also in the way she dresses. Just a real, like, a slippy house dress. Short. She sandals. She wears that outside, inside, doesn't matter. It's just like, fine. It's not a thought going into making herself up. One thing goes on, boom, I'm dressed. And that's the way she lives.
And like a lot of her behavior, it's a little like kind of not her age, sort of, right? Like age inappropriate behavior as well. It's a little childlike, her dress, and her behavior is often very childlike. Yeah, as I was saying, this is the first of one of many just very uncomfortable gatherings that happen in this movie. We also have like the kids party, the beach party, the multiple welcome home parties. So many just awkward encounters going on through this movie. Mabel behaving strangely, but Nick is also behaving very strangely. You know what I mean? This is the through line of the movie.
Refrain.
Yeah.
The common refrain is that her behavior is described, it's acknowledged by everybody, it's spoken about in hushed tones, they're trying to gauge her, and it is confusing and can be off-putting. In this spaghetti dinner scene, she keeps asking people their name, and they're polite about it and entertaining. They know, they have a little familiarity, but obviously some, they don't know her, and they're kind of looking at her strange. She starts to act a little kookier. Mm-hmm. But Nick is the one that drives people away. Like reaction to her behavior is what people can't be around. And they all use as an excuse his phone call to his mom as after he smacks her. He doesn't smack her yet. He yells at her. And they all are like, fuck, we're in the middle of some domestic drama. They use him taking a phone call as an excuse to beat feet out the door. Like, you get the feeling if he would have handled it differently, it would have been acceptable. It's
exactly.
He's actually crazier, but we don't acknowledge that.
Yes. And that's a theme that just keeps coming back over and over and over again. Like, she says something strange, but he says something just as strange, if not stranger. He has this comment here where he just will not drop it, where he says, like, you know, you could go 8-9 months without seeing a baby, and then suddenly there's a baby, right? And it's like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, and he won't drop it. But, like, she also doesn't know when to quit either.
Right.
Like, these two, they just, like, they keep pushing past the point. And then pushing a little bit further and then pushing further. But yeah, Nick, I mean, there's the scene where he's in bed. It's been a long night. People are coming in. He wants them to leave. But then suddenly he's the one who was telling people, get in the bed.
Right.
You know, it's just, he is just one way and then he's completely the other way after that. I don't want to skip over the
dress-up party,
weird kids party that is thrown in. Poor Mr. Jensen. Poor Mr. Jensen.
I knew I recognized this guy. I was like, who is this guy? And I was like, oh, I know who he is. He's the guy who was in the Ernest movies. He was Gail Yard Sartan's partner, the little guy Bobby who didn't speak, but he was like really weird. And then I was like,
wow.
No, that's not him.
Not him.
I looked it up. He's the trainer in Raging Bull. He's Jake LaMotta's trainer at the beginning, who after he throws the first fight, he's crying in the locker room with him. And one of my favorite movies ever. And so I know this guy's face. But
I mix
naturalistic
up,
actor as hell.
Raging Bull and Ernest Goes to Camp all the time. I mix those two movies.
I'm going to get you a side-by-side.
So much common DNA. And if you play Dark Side of the Moon, nothing happens.
I'm telling you.
But
man,
yeah, oh my God, this party is just so fucking, all these parties are so awful.
It's
like
just
they're
a
doing
play date.
Swad Lake. Yeah, right.
It's a parent bringing some kids over to hang out and play.
And it becomes
and he
this whole
is,
fucking thing. Yeah.
He is sketchy, sketched out from jump, the way she answers the door, he's like, what am I dropping my kids off at?
The Swan Lake. Come and die for Mr. Jensen, everybody. It's just like so fucking bizarre. His kids are running around naked. And then Nick comes home in the middle of all this, of course. And then he freaks out, slaps her, and then turns to Mr. Jensen and says, see what you made me do.
Yeah.
This is just such a bizarre relationship. And there's just everyone gets like a front row seat to it as well. You know, I just think back to actually the first scene of the film where the crew goes into the bar and Nick is talking on the phone and everyone quiets down, right? Like they're just like, hang on, what's going on over here with Nick? Like front row seat to all of this insanity. I mean, everyone gets it, whether they want it or not. I love later after he gets, after the Mabel's put in an institution, we jump cut again from this like really horrible scene with the kids and the screaming and the doctor and all this other kind of stuff to Nick at work. He's berating someone. He says, you're a silent son of a bitch. Like, how dare you not talk to me like that? How dare you?
Like, after he's yelling at everybody for talking about his business. And then somebody's like actually being like, chill around him.
Don't talk to me? No, you're not talking to me? And then that guy falls like down a hill.
You want to talk about accidentally funny. That was the part of the movie I was like, holy shit. And I started cracking up because I did not expect this guy just to fall down a mountain. I was that was all right, pretty, John Cassavetes movie, they're natural. Pretty, you know, we're using real
out
set.
Out of the fucking blue. Yeah. Ooh. Yeah, it's pretty wild. But this, again, this inspires this impromptu beach party where he decides that he's not created enough like meaningful emotional scars for the children. So he like pulls them out of school. It's like 10 a.m. in the morning. He just pulls them out of school.
Him and he's a coworker.
Screaming like a maniac the entire time. It's like, how do you feel good?
I'm going with my dad's coworker to the beach.
And then it's just, they take some of the most miserable beach. He's dragging them around. And I love it. At one point, like, there's three kids. One of them, like, goes off with a coworker. Okay, let's dig in the sand, right? Yeah. He takes the other two kids, and he's, for some reason, like, determined to walk in complete opposite direction.
Just
one of the girl breaks away, is like, oh, I'm going to run over here and dig in the sand. He runs back, picks her up, and just keeps dragging her back in this other turn. Like, why the fuck is he doing this? His behavior is so fucking bizarre. But like I said, yeah, recognizable. But I think this is the point where it tips over into just bizarre comedy at a certain point, because it just then they're in the back of the truck. He's giving them beer and it starts innocently enough as like, oh, I'll have a taste of beer. Fine. The kids are stumbling into bed wasted by the end of that truck ride. Like, how is that any less irresponsible than anything that Mabel did? It's not, right?
Right.
And then we jump cut. Here's another, it's not a literal jump cut, but a sort of narrative jump cut to 6 months later. And you just think like, oh God, what was that 6 months like? Like, how horrible was that 6 months? Because what do we jump into right away? An absolute storm of chaos and insanity. Like, we're running down a hill to jump into a moving truck and change our clothes in the moving truck, because we have to get to Mabel's welcome home from the mental institution, let's all get hammered party that he's throwing
full
at their house with like a full, like, she's coming out of a mental institution. Yeah. That's not something she's proud of at all. But again, he is just, it's this storm of chaos that always surrounds them. And then someone finally confronts him and says, are you crazy? Like, someone actually asks him, are you crazy? And what does he do? He just wanders out in the rain, shouts at everyone who is watching the scene to go back inside, then tells his mother to tell everyone inside to go back outside. Then as she's doing that, he interrupts her and very politely asks everyone to go outside. This is this insane scene of people leaving the house that Mabel returns home to. Ironically, the family only get together, this quiet dinner is somehow worse. It's worse than having like having Animal House like to come up to from a mental institution. This is actually just close family. Worse. So much worse.
Back on Scared Daniel, we watched a movie called Straitjacket with Joan Crawford.
Oh, and boy.
That return from a mental institution
is
so much better than this return from a mental institution. He has no concept of what his wife needs and the best way to be around her. And she's actually got the skills now a little bit to tell him, I need regiment behavior. I need the way that... I don't know how to interact without the way the hospital has kind of conditioned me to interact. Well, you're not getting that. You're getting be this way. Be this way only. Yeah. And if I think you're not at it enough, I'm going to turn it up. If I think you're at too much, I'm going to turn you down.
And I'm
He almost fights her dad.
He's ready to fight everyone all of the time. Yeah. Again, coworkers, friends, family, himself.
The neighbor's kids.
He's also just confounding, as I said, like, just be yourself is what he says. He's bothered by the fact that she's ditched her old mannerisms, her and her thumb and get out of here and all that. And he says, just be yourself, right? Like, she starts breaking down. She's performing at the table. She's basically acting like a child again. Nick goes fucking insane. Freaks the fuck out. And then tells her, be yourself.
Yeah.
What do you fucking want? Like, what is the one... What could possibly make you happy with those kind of directives? It's just...
One thing that...
It's a no-win situation.
While I watched it, I was like, whoa, that's kind of... Wow, that's rough. But now that I'm, you know, kind of formulating how he's... matching her craziness, but he just doesn't get called out. He threatens children's lives a couple times. I will kill those son of a bitch and kids. To the kids, telling them they'll murder. She never does that shit.
That's not exactly. Yeah. Like his psychosis comes with violence attached. Hers doesn't. Mm-hmm. Okay, like it comes with a lot of other stuff, and it's not like she doesn't endanger them necessarily. Or wouldn't endanger them, but not in that sort of a way, right? She never goes to any sort of place like that. But yeah, once he kicks everybody out, kicks all the family out, and then, I mean, the scene just gets like worse and worse and worse. He threatens to kill her. He threatens to kill the kids in front of the kids. She finally tries to slice her wrists open. They're barely able to pull the razor out of her hand.
The kids are coming to her rescue, like performing a barrier around her.
There's then this other, almost callback, weirdly, to the beach scene where he drags the kids upstairs, and then they run back downstairs. This happens, like, three times, dragging the kids upstairs, running back downstairs, hurt them to protect your mom. And then, just out of the blue, like I said, it's just, like, the crowd's clear, this sort of shared psychosis, whatever is happening here, they're somehow able to get it together enough to bring it down, calm it down, get the kids to bed, and say, don't worry about it. Like, everything's fine. Let's make a little joke about it, right, as we're going downstairs. And it's just like, what the fuck have you done? Yeah, and as they're alone together, you know, it leaves on this very... this kind of ambiguous note, because she asks if he loves her. He doesn't say anything. And then there's this very strange song that plays. Not the kind of emotional sort of ballad or anything like that, but just something that's really wacky. And they just go about the business of their marriage as though nothing of this ever happened, right? Like, it's just like they're doing things that the way they clean up the table... The dining room is also their bedroom, which is right in the middle of the house. There's no spot for peace anywhere. There's a door that says private, but there's no privacy in this entire house. But the way they put everything back is the way of, like, again, a couple who has done this so many times that they know where the other one's going. You know, I'm going to grab these dishes and I'm going to put them, and then I'm going to go over here, and we don't need to negotiate. Which way are you going? You know, like, they're doing it as though they've just done it a million times, and then off to bed and do it all tomorrow. You know? Like, it's just, it's brutal. It's absolutely brutal. But it does leave on this note of, like, I don't know, what's the best path forward for these people? Again, these are very not wealthy people at all, in any way, shape, or form. So they do have a house, but it's not, this is not a family of means. So anyway, Corky. Last thoughts, sir. On A Woman Under the Influence before we give our ratings.
The performances are just fantastic. If you see this movie, see it for Gina Rowlands just giving just an amazing performance. It took me a bit to settle into it, but that scene where she comes back from the hospital. And she's at, it's the first time you see her composed and uneasy, but not expressing the unease through manic behavior. She's just kind of holding it in. And it is so much acting and conveying without saying a word of being behind a mask as an actor. Oh, it's fucking fantastic. And then I love the naturalistic look of it, this whole movie. I love the natural light. I love that they're actually in this, you know, gorgeous, probably 20s or 30s built home in Los Angeles. I love the look of the street in 70s Los Angeles when she goes to a bar at night, or when they're cruising around. Even when they're at the beach, like, they're at a beach, right? There is not a single shot of an ocean. Like you see it in the background. It's not wide open. It's just tight on everybody. It's just them in the sand. It's gritty real. Like you said, even when you're in a fucking wide open beach, you're claustrophobic. You can't escape these people. They can't escape themselves. No wonder he's always trying to wrangle everybody run back in.
Yeah. It's that omnipresent feeling of just tension and oppression and just
chaos, like, and unease,
a lack of personal space. Chaos, utter chaos. And people who seem to be kind of, like I said, addicted to chaos in a way, like any chance for the chaos to go away, they ultimately seem to reject it and embrace the chaos. All right, let's remind people about our rating system. Of course, we rate on the sight or sound scale. If we both think it was a sound selection, then kaboom, right into the cannon fodder cannon it goes. If one or both of us thought it was a wee bit slight, no cannon for you, but we'll select a slighted film not in the sight and sound 250 to put in its place. Corky, A Woman Under the Influence, slight or sound.
This movie, as I said, was a difficult watch for me. I think it'd be a difficult watch for anybody, but just like really on one butt cheek watching the whole time. Kind of like the feeling Uncut Gems gives you, but just a little different reason. It's sound. It's a sound film. It's 45% for me. So it's 55, just sound.
It just tipped. Just tipped over. Yeah.
Performance. It's sound with slightish tendencies.
Oh man, if I had a nickel for every time someone said that about me. Oh boy. For me, it's a 100-0. Well, you know, you always got to have a seed of doubt. Let's say 99-1.
Gotcha.
This is a no doubt, almost no doubt, classic to me. Great film. I haven't seen every Cassavetes film. I still haven't seen Love Streams, which is also in this.
I never even heard of Love Streams. Top
250. Yeah, it was one of his last films from the mid 80s.
Okay.
Yeah.
I know we talked last episode.
This is
about
my favorite.
Sorry, yeah, I interrupted you. I know we talked last episode about how his son made She's So Lovely, but that was actually a John Cassavetes script. The only unreleased thing that they had of his. And so Nick Cassavetes made it.
There you go. Yeah, and I'm not sure how you pronounce it. X-A-N Cassavetes also had a brief. She's been in some films, I think.
Yeah, and there's a granddaughter running around somewhere too, right?
Zoe Cassavetes, yeah. I think. Yeah. So there's just Cassavetes just running around all over the place.
Talented family.
You, but if you ever make a film even half as good as A Woman Under the Influence, you're a pretty damn good filmmaker, because I think this is an amazing film. That's two sound selections. That means kaboom, the cannons roar, and into the cannon fodder cannon goes John and Jenna. And let's not forget Peter screaming his fucking head off just at everyone, just screaming, "Where's that other teacher?" Like, this is the principal of the school. Anyway, sorry.
That's what we thought about Woman Under the Influence, but what did you think about the film? Did you watch it with us? Had you seen it before? We'd love to hear your take on it. Leave us a comment on your favorite podcast app or contact us on Facebook and Instagram at Dare Daniel Pod. Tell us your thoughts.
All right, now it's time to randomly select the film we'll be reviewing in 2 weeks on our next episode. You ready for this, Quirky?
Yeah, let's go.
Hit the button. Boop, 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 beep. Corky, how much do you love Central Florida? Because we're going to Orlando. Oh, different Orlando. Wrong Orlando. Totally different Orlando. This is what? Virginia Woolf's Orlando.
Bullshit.
1992 film directed by Sally Potter. No Disney World for you. No Universal theme park. Nothing.
This
sir.
Is the biopic about Tony Orlando and Don.
This is Sally Potter directing Virginia Woolf's Orlando, starring my girl Tilda Swinton and your guy Billy Zane.
That is my guy, though.
Yeah, it is. Letterboxd synopsis. England, 1600. Queen Elizabeth I promises Orlando, a young nobleman obsessed with poetry, that she will grant him land and fortune if he agrees to satisfy a very particular request. Corky, have you seen Orlando?
Have not seen it, but this is where I first heard of Tilda Swinton. I know it's she plays men and women in this movie, or just a man. But I had heard of this movie in the 90s. I remember it was kind of an independent hit.
Man and woman. Quirky. Okay. Spoiler alert. That's the whole bit. This was, I think, my first encounter with Tilda Swinton, although I've since seen some of the Derek Sherman films that she did in the 80s and before this. But yeah, it's been at least 30 years, I would guess, since I've seen it. So I'm excited to see it again.
Okay.
If you want to play along at home, you can stream it with ads on the Roku channel. This is a channel that apparently exists. If you wanted to go a more traditional route, you could rent or buy it on all of the usual VOD apps and services, Prime, Apple TV, Fandango, Google Play, YouTube. You could probably name more, but they are all there. And let's all take a trip to the most magical place on earth, 1600 England, for Orlando.
Until then, follow Dare Daniel Pod on Facebook and Instagram. Like and rate us on your favorite podcast app. If you'd like to donate to the show, visit daredaniel.com. Find support the show in the menu or look for the donate button. For Cannon Fodder, I'm Corky McDonald.
And I'm Daniel Barnes, saying until next time, save us a seat in the back row.